I'm Jim Hartley. I'm professor of economics at Mount Holyoke College. And I guess my question is for you, Ms. Kimball. There's a curious phenomenon I've noticed a lot of the conservative attack on the academy and in the multicultural realm. And I work at Mount Holyoke College, I'm well aware, and I fully agree about all of the things you said about what's going on in the academy. That's not the curious part, I think. You're absolutely right. But what I find curious is the way conservatives seem to respond to it. And the two big proposals that come up are, one, the abolition of tenure, which as a conservative prof, I can say tenure protects conservatives, not the multiculturalists, or the idea that one needs to send one student to better kinds of colleges, which I think is also invaluable advice to parents. But the reality is many parents are sending their kids to schools because they want them to get jobs at Goldman Sachs. And if you want to get a job at Goldman Sachs, going to Harvard or Mount Holyoke is a much better route to do that. And what I've been noticing at Mount Holyoke is, when the students are entering, they have already completely absorbed the multicultural agenda. When I teach my first-year students in their first semester of college, they have already believed everything that we see, these constant attack on the academy, and we say all the professors are teaching them. They already believe all of this. They have no moral center. They have no firm beliefs. They don't believe in American exceptionalism. They have, you know, they've fully bought the multicultural agenda. And I guess I'm wondering if the conservative attack on the academy isn't becoming counterproductive, in a sense, by focusing the attention at this one place in the academy, we're missing the broader phenomenon that the parents of the current students all went to school in the late 1970s. They've already believed this. They're raising their children in homes that do not, you know, have this idea, all the sort of centered culture we might like them to have, and why the conservative attack hasn't broadened out in a sense to just try to talk to the parents of the future children, and why it's still largely an attack on the academy.
Thank you. That's a very interesting question. I mean, I think that it has to be a much broader response, and indeed, the phenomenon you just described is certainly the case. I mean, it's the virus of cultural relativism has metastasized, if viruses can metastasize, from the colleges and universities to the secondary schools, and indeed, in many cases, to the primary schools. It's also moved out into government bureaucracies. What John describes as transnational progressivism is merely the same virus writ large in the sort of international arena. Part of my remarks that I didn't get to because of time was the suggestion that it may seem paradoxical, but I don't really think it is, that one of the most fundamental challenges to conservatism, which is the sort of broad rubric of this conference, is a failure of liberalism. And by that I mean that, I mean not the liberalism in the sort of its current manifestation, that is to say, a sort of rancid leftism, but the sort of more red-blooded liberalism of an Edmund Burke, let's say. There's a kind of an antinomy that seems to be an ingredient in liberalism in its autumnal phases. And this is something that Alan Bloom, for example, pointed out in the closing of The American Mind. He focused, of course, mostly on elite colleges and universities, but it can be generalized, I think. And the antinomy is this, that liberal regimes, by making a virtue, indeed by making the virtue tolerance and openness, what Bloom called openness, leave themselves vulnerable to those elements that would seek to undermine the liberal regime precisely by the use and abuse of those privileges granted by openness. So on the one hand, it's absolutely imperative for the good multiculturalist or transnational progressivist or whatever to say, we are good liberals, therefore we are tolerant of other people's points of view, we are open to other things, even if we personally find them morally abhorrent, you know, with, you know, the female circumcision or whatever, even indeed to those folks who will come to our country, use our freedoms to undermine the very freedoms that we are granting them. On the other hand, if they're intolerant to those things, say these people, they seem to think that they're somehow fundamentally betraying the liberal ethos by betraying this commitment to tolerance and so on. Now, I mean, I think there's a pretty easy way out of this apparent contradiction or antinomy, whatever you want to call it, namely to look to a sort of an older tradition of liberalism, as I say, a more red-blooded one, represented, for example, by Charles Napier when he was governing India for the Brits. He was confronted with this problem that it was a vigorous local custom that this chap dies and they put his widow on the funeral pyre with him. And he said, well, okay, that's your custom, but our custom is to hang people that do that. So you build the funeral pyre and we build a gallows right next door. And that put an end to that particular local custom. And what enabled him to do that was that he had beliefs beyond this kind of vacuous tolerance, openness, and so on. And we too have those beliefs if we only had confidence in them. We believe, as John was and Nick were talking about, in the rule of law. We believe in individual freedom. We believe in liberty, not license. Liberty that's contained by certain values and so on. And it seems to me that the most fundamental challenge to Western civilization, whether it's this country or Europe or wherever, is this kind of failure of nerve, a loss of belief in those animating values that made us great, that indeed allowed us to become the masters and possessors of nature, as Descartes put it. If we travel much farther down that path, it will be a journey toward suicide.
First, the question, Nick, among the four alternatives that you mentioned, did you mention unilateral free trade, unilateral removal of your tariffs? Because that, if you didn't, I have a comment.
Right. I would obviously think that that's what a free market means, and the objective is to promote that worldwide.
Oh, but I'm not assuming that countries remove unilaterally their barriers as a joint accord. I mean, a country can remove theirs just by themselves, like Chile did in the early 70s and prospered quite a bit. Because I think that's the best way to globalize, is by each country doing his own policy and removing its own tariffs. After all, the tariffs are against one's people. They're not against the foreigner. Foreigners don't pay duties in the United States. It's just Americans. But there's another point that I think is not generally considered. Private property, there's only two ways to enjoy your private property. One is by enjoying the use of it, and the other is by trading it in exchange for other people's rights, property, on whatever they give you. So opposition to free trade is based on the fact that you lose the right of your property because of the political place of residency of the person you're trading with. Now, property rights don't depend on that. Property rights depend on the legitimacy of your acquisition. And whether you dispose of it through trade or not, or wherever a person lives, has nothing to do with it. So I think this is another factor that must be considered in this debate on globalization. And I state in this little book I'm going to send you pretty soon, that that people that are in favor of property rights aren't aware that they are against property rights when they oppose globalization, because it's just allowing people to trade with people that live in a different country. Like if you were once in Bratislava trading with somebody in Prague before they divided the country, nobody cared. Now they divided the country. Now it's international trade, so everybody has something to say about it.
Yes, my name is Michael McAvoy, and I'd like to weigh in on this question about whether the academy is responsible for liberalism being introduced into our culture. And I would like to suggest that that problem goes back further than and deeper than just the academy, and ask you for input on that. And that is, what impact do you think it has on the introduction of liberalism that schools are publicly funded and publicly managed? That seems like the introduction of the first great welfare program in America, and it's spread from there. What would you think?
Okay. Are you directing that to anyone in particular, or to all of us?
Just general.
Okay.
Well, I would agree with you that the problem goes back further than the current the academy as it's currently formed. I think I mentioned that I went back to Rousseau, for example, but and Romanticism. One could go back even further, I suppose. But do I think that public funding of schools is a bad thing? No, I don't. I support the homeschooling movement, but and I would certainly I would support vouchers. But I think it's also a good idea that that we have publicly funded schools. If I understood your question, but
actually, I'd like to answer the I guess there wasn't the previous gentleman about the trade issue. Because he raised, that's exactly what I was talking about. He talked about an absolute right to trade, which trumped democratic government. Now, the people have a right to make mistakes. So if the Czechs, once they became separate from Slovaks, they set up some, their parliament passed legislation restricting goods. Well, that's a mistake, but as a free people, they have the right to do that. Otherwise, you're saying that the right to trade trumps democratic self-government. I don't know how that would be enforced, or how that possibly would work. But that is exactly the point that I think it's a major question that consists the main point of my talk, in a sense. That conservatives are facing this with globalization. What is the higher priority? Is it democratic self-government? That would be limited government, constitutionalism, the American Constitution, in our case. Or is it simply absolute, the absolute right to trade with anybody in the world? Well, we don't have that right. You don't have the right to trade, let's say, with someone in China for weapons. Adam Smith didn't believe you had that right. He didn't believe that, he didn't want to trade the naval stores in North America. He wanted to hold those stores for the British Navy. He didn't believe in the absolute right of trade. He believed that the defense needs of the British nation were more important than trade. So I'm glad you raised the question. I completely disagree with your point. And that's exactly what I wanted to point out. I want to make just one more quick point as we're thinking globalization, trade is great, laissez-faire. The left, the sophisticated left, is taking the next step, too. I point to someone like Harold Meyerson, who writes monthly column in the Washington Post. And he said, yes, the left should embrace globalization, but remember the history of the United States. There was a period of laissez-faire from 1870 to 1933. So fine, you'll have your laissez-faire period, and then we'll have a global New Deal. And that's the idea behind the labor standards, the environmental standards, creating a transnational regulatory agency. So the sophisticated left already has their eye on the ball, and their goal is a global New Deal. Because they figure after, it's always start with laissez-faire, but then people basically get tired of laissez-faire, and then it moves to a New Deal. And someday we'll have a global great society, I suppose.
Let me just address the education question that was raised. I very much support the notion of privatization of the school system, because you will not get the benefits of competition without the privatization. And as long as you have unions committed themselves to the agenda of the left, it's not going to work. I think an argument that can be made here is a kind of rhetorical move that I would suggest, and it goes something like the following: right, if you don't support globalization in the sense in which I just described it, okay, you are denying yourself, your children, and the rest of the world the opportunity for a better and freer life. Right. I think that point has to be made over and over, and I think once that message gets out, the movement in this direction will go a lot further. So the argument in the end has to be not just that the other side is wrong about the facts and the logic and how they're connected, but that the human welfare is at stake here. And I would suggest, for example, as a something that we could all do, I would like to found a museum of shame, preferably in New York. And it will prominently feature the New York Times. And we will do a history of all of the bad things that have been suggested in the way of public policy in the last 200 years, and have, you know, interesting dioramas to display them, and then make the case that hundreds of millions of people have had their lives destroyed because of bad policy and the misunderstanding of what globalization is about. So I mean, I think that there's a rhetorical battle here. There are no arguments on the other side. There is only a rhetoric of complaint by people who have failed in one way or another to grasp what it means to be a fit participant in a kind of global society that we're talking about. So instead of being defensive, I suggest going on the offensive.
I'm Monty Brown from the Earhart Foundation. My question is also to Roger Kimball, and it's about the last part of your talk, which was defense of prejudice. What I found the most interesting part of an interesting talk on the whole, but I'm not persuaded, and I have a three-part question. Fortunately, the first two parts are pretty brief. The very first is rhetorical. I just think if the concept was right, presenting it as a defense of prejudice, starting where we are at this time, is sort of beginning with something like a kick me sign on your back, that the base in those terms is discrimination is, or being discriminating. It's also difficult, but not as difficult as trying to defend the concept of prejudice in the first place. The second element of it follows what Professor Hartley said, that I think that where we find ourselves now, and with young people looking to the future generation, their prejudices aren't what prejudice, the prejudice that Edmund Burke was speaking about, and the way their minds have been formed is just, it's different now from what Burke spoke about in some fundamental ways. And the shorthand that I could offer for this is what Leo Strauss spoke about is the cave beneath the cave. I don't know if you're familiar with that part of Strauss's writing, but again, to make the point most simply, that the prejudices of the young people that are coming into Professor Hartley's classroom at one of our better colleges are not an essentially healthy or solid ground for construction, we could say. And the third side is philosophical, that even if we did have we didn't have the rhetorical problem. And even if we did have a primary and secondary education system that was more solid, wouldn't we still really want to champion something that points beyond prejudice, call it understanding or true judgment, something like that? That I agree with you that openness for its own sake is a cause of many of our problems. Alan Bloom critiqued that, but not as a, he wasn't against openness altogether. He was against openness that wasn't willing to go any further, wasn't interested in trying to seek understanding or to apply discernment. So thank you for your time, and those are my questions.
Well, the first part of question has really a rhetorical issue. Is the game kind of up on the word prejudice, that it's so indelibly linked to bigotry that the idea of actually telling the truth, we should give up on that? I don't think we should. I think that that Burke was right when he said that in his defense of prejudice, or when Russell Kirk in the Conservative Mind, so the whole beginning part of that book, or a large part of it, is devoted to defending prejudice in Burkean terms. This is their point. There is to show that we all rely on prejudice, something called prejudice. We rely on prejudgment. That's what the word prejudice means. And to pretend that we don't is to fool ourselves. And it seems to me that we live in an increasingly pusillanimous culture that is unwilling to tell the truth about things, a culture that is increasingly subject to the dictates of political correctness, and that there are many things in which it's very difficult to tell the truth about, but especially if you're in the business of seeking after the truth, if you're a professor, say, or a journalist, or a commentator, then you should seek to tell the truth. And one of the truths is that Burke was right, that just prejudice renders a man's virtue his habit. In other words, that words like custom or manners or tradition or the conventional, these are all words that have been delegitimated by a liberal tradition going back at least to John Stuart Mill. And they are words that I think are worthy of reclaiming. Sure, you certainly would be hanging a sign on yourself. Maybe it doesn't say kick me, but it would certainly get your students to stop and think. I mean, I think if you went into class and said, you know, let's actually think about what prejudice really means, and maybe we've been too hasty. Sure, there are bad examples of prejudice. There, you want to remain open in the sense that you are sensitive to new evidence and that you are not captive of mere stereotypes and so on. But that is not to say that you shouldn't be able to tell the truth about these things. Now, to your more philosophical part of your point, I mean, I think that the German philosopher Gadamer, Hans Georg Gadamer, was right when he spoke about the Enlightenment's fundamental project as being the prejudice against prejudice, the idea that somehow we could emancipate ourselves, and again, this is linked also to Mill, we could emancipate ourselves from all of these, the past, really. And Gadamer criticized that, and I think quite rightly that, you know, we can't. We are, to some extent, creatures of our past, and that our real task is to use reason to try to discriminate, again, another word, as you pointed out, that has been enrolled in the index of forbidden terms, that use reason to discriminate between those aspects of convention, custom, tradition, and so on that are fruitful and those that aren't. So I recognize, of course, that to mount a defense of prejudice is provocative, but it's a provocation that I think is well worth undertaking.
Steve Balch, I like the suggestion that Nick made about opening up a museum of shame, but actually we already have one. If you see the National History Museum down in Washington, the Smithsonian, very much a museum of shame, and there are quite a few other museums of shame around the country. It's well in operation. And I think, you know, if you
excuse me, Steve, those are shameful museums, not museums of shame.
No, actually they are museums of shame. And shame is a big project, and I think, picking up on Roger's presentation, if you really want to understand multiculturalism, that's what multiculturalism is about. It's a project to shame the country. It's a project to shame it to the point where it will accept the rulership of this new ascending elite that we have, that you can find not only in the United States, but throughout the world. It's a way of humbling people so as to establish a claim to rule them on the part of folks who put themselves forward as being much more virtuous and much more enlightened and representing a kind of dawning new age. And it seems to me that if we want to deal with the argument that's being put forward by the perverse side of globalism about immigration into the United States, that's something that we have to counterattack. One can argue that we should exert ourselves as a democracy, and it's the people who are already in the country who have the right to determine who comes in. That argument certainly will have a lot of appeal, but I think some people will be resistant to it on the grounds that who are we? Those of us already here, those of us who are the descendants, after all, of earlier immigrants, to shut the door behind us, to claim this wonderful patrimony to ourselves and lock others out. Doesn't democracy fail at that point as a justification? And I think there may be others, too, conservatives, who will say, well, you're talking about majoritarian democracy, but you know, the real democracy is the democracy of the marketplace, where each individual makes choices. Wall Street Journal may see it that way. Each individual is making choices for himself or herself, and the majority shouldn't be able to shut down those choices. I think the argument, nonetheless, is a good one, but maybe it needs to be buttressed by a further argument about democracy, and that is that our claim to control our borders is not simply that we represent a self-governing community and therefore should have that right. Our claim to control our borders is a claim to preserve something that could easily be destroyed if there is unhindered and, I'll say, unselective immigration. That despite our Wilsonian optimism, democracy is a fragile flower. It's certainly something that has value to the entire world if it's established in a few places. Its influence radiates out, but it has to be preserved in those few places. It can't be taken for granted. And the culture that supports it is a culture that has historically evolved over time and could easily be inundated by other types of influences, the more typical human non-democratic norm. And we need to preserve it. Now, we can only make that argument if we feel proud of our democratic liberal civilization. So I think restoring that pride is probably a prior element to even making that kind of argument. But a conservationist argument, I think, might be as powerful and could augment, supplement, the kind of procedural democratic argument that you were suggesting we also make. I think both need to be made and can only be effectively made if we get beyond multiculturalism by a kind of rebirth of pride in ourselves and our community.
Well, one interesting thing about the multicultural transnational connection is I found looking at some of the same, this very same professors who were experts on multiculturalism in the 1990s, in the 21st century started talking about multiculturalism. I mean, started talking about transnationalism, and they simply made the switch. Alejandro Portes is a professor of president of the American Sociological Association. He was big multicultural expert, and now he's a big transnational expert because he said these immigrant communities are transnational, from El Salvador, let's say, to the United States. He used to think of it just as a multicultural community in the United States. Now he says, well, it's transnational. It's connected to El Salvador. So there's a direct connection between multiculturalism and transnationalism. And Steve's point, I don't think it's pure majoritarian democracy. I'm talking about constitutionalism. I'm talking about the American constitutional system, we the people decide our immigration policy, and the Wall Street Journal would like it decided by autonomous individuals in other countries that aren't. So that's a post-constitutional argument. That's an argument beyond the United States Constitution. I think that's one of our strongest arguments.
Maybe a general comment. I think there's a tendency because of the kind of work that we're involved in, that we're idea people, so we're academics and journalists, et cetera, maybe to worry too much about what's going on in the academic world. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't take the threats seriously. But maybe sometimes if we put this into historical perspective, there's room for optimism. For example, we send our children to Ivy League schools knowing what kinds of professors they're going to teach there, because that will ensure that they get jobs at Goldman Sachs. So I think that as long as we don't lose sight of the fact that people want to work at Goldman Sachs, that's the important thing. When they don't want to work at Goldman Sachs, then I would begin to worry about what's happening. Or if we look at economics in the United States, after the Second World War, the former colonies sent their best and brightest people to Britain, to France, and to the United States to study economics so that they can go back and turn their countries into modern commercial societies. And what they learned between 1950 and 1980 in American universities of higher education and economics was Keynesianism in one form or another. And so they went back to their countries and proceeded to make an incredible mess. I'm tempted to use profanity here, but I'll resist. All right. Now, who would have believed in 1960, for example, that by 1980 it would now be respectable to argue for free markets in economics programs in the United States? Could Reagan have been elected without asking the question, are you better off now
than you were 4 years ago. People may be ill-informed, misinformed, and they may be misled by the media, etc. But the one thing they're committed to is a better life. And no matter how many times we take one step backward, we still have had up until now an opportunity to take two steps forward. And I think if we don't give up that historical perspective, it's important. Otherwise, we'll become too optimistic and maybe not have the courage to continue to promote the kind of ideas that we do.
My name is Mignon Sass, and I'm from the University of Dallas. My question is directed toward all of you, and it has to do with, I think, a problem that I'm not hearing a conservative voice address in any sort of offensive way, but rather defensively, which is that both the kind of multiculturalism that is described in terms of the problems in the academy and problems that people might encounter with globalization in the market economy. But both of those issues, liberals will voice concern with regard to those who are marginalized, those who are weak, those who are vulnerable, right? So, you know, in multicultural studies, there's an elevation of all of these traditionally marginalized groups of people, elevating them because they've been ignored in the same way that you know, conservatives would get really outraged by the professor who ignores teaching the Holocaust because this was a whole group of people that was, you know, that Germans attempted to eliminate. And so multiculturalism is just elevating other groups of people that have been marginalized. And likewise, in globalization of the world economy, this comment that we can't have the benefits of technology without a free market economy. Technology is an expression of our freedom, but perhaps it's an expression of our freedom at the expense of someone else's freedom. I guess that, so I'm wondering, how can we, how can the conservative movement express a concern for the weak and the vulnerable while preserving conservative ideas, which to my understanding is not just valuing freedom, right, but also valuing other goods, truth, goodness, perhaps even beauty. I mean, do we really want the Walmartization of the whole entire planet? Is that really what's good? So I just wanted to put that out there.
Right. Our time is almost up, so I'm going to ask the last person in line to raise a question as well. I don't know if we'll have time to answer it, but at least I want you to get your comment or question in.
Yes. Dan Skitzinger from the Russell Kirk Center. I'm having actually a similar question. I'm a little bit puzzled. Is it possible that globalization, in contrast to embracing individual autonomy and liberty, may actually limit it to the extent that, and others have raised that I'm no longer free to live on a farm?